Today's class is entitled, How to Manage Relationships, Proverbs 25, verses 5 through 17. Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ. Proverbs chapter 27. The title for this section, or the key, I think, to this particular chapter, as our chairman has said, is How to Manage Relationships. So what we're going to do first is I'm going to give you a breakup of the chapter, and then, as usual, given there's too much material in the chapter to cover, we're going to look at just one section by way of illustration of the spirit of the whole. So chapter 27, then, is on the subject of how to manage relationships, because, you see, it's most important for a king that he knows how to do this. And I believe that the chapter divides as follows. Firstly, verses 1 to 4, attitude to oneself. One's attitude to oneself. You see, that's where it all begins. Depending on what we think, what we feel about ourselves, will tend to govern the other relationships that we have in life. And so there are exhortations there as to the right and proper attitude that we should have concerning our own position in life. Then verses 5 to 17, which God willing we'll look at this morning, is relationships with friends. Relationships with friends, verses 5 to 17. So terribly, terribly important, and so important for kings. Kings also needed friends, true friends, that they could rely on in time of crisis. Verses 18 to 22, it concerns the matter of dealings with servants. Dealings with servants. And finally, verses 23 to 27, care of the household. Care of the household. So you see, here are all the principal relationships that a king would experience in life. His own attitude to himself, his closest advisors and friends that were clustered about him, his dealings with the rest of the servants that came under his authority, and finally the care of the royal household itself, his own family, and I suppose ultimately extending out to the very realm of the kingdom itself, because in a sense, you see, all the subjects are part of the greater household that the king has responsibility for. So these are the relationships that the king must learn to manage if he would be wise. Well, we're going to look then at verses 5 to 17 this morning on the matter of relationships with friends. How wonderful a theme and a subject this is. Now, you'll notice then that verse 5 starts by saying this. It says, open rebuke is better than secret love. Open rebuke is better than secret love. Or as Green says, an alternative translation of the Hebrew, better is reproof revealed than love concealed. For Moffat's, better a frank word of reproof than the love that will not speak. So why is it better? Why is the rebuke that is revealed better than the secret love here? Well, the answer is because, you see, this secret love of the fifth verse is the love of admiration or adoration, but it only tends to flattery. In fact, flattery is one of the most dangerous things, especially for kings, isn't it? To be subject to flattery. And I think the lesson of the verse, you see, is that genuine friendship is characterized by that love that actually seeks the ultimate good of the other and not merely their admiration. The secret love here is of the person who thinks that the other is wonderful and can only flatter them even when they're wrong. That's not what true friendship's all about. True friendship is when we seek the ultimate good of the other person. And so the lesson of this verse is that in friendships that a rebuke, if kindly given, will cement the bond of friendship rather than rupture it. Come and have a look at chapter 9 by way of illustration of this principle. Of course, the rebuke needs to be given in the right way, doesn't it? But assuming that it is given in the right way, the lesson is that true friendships, in fact, are nurtured by those moments of rebuke that friends give to one another. It will actually cement their relationship. Proverbs 9 says, and in the 8th verse, these words, rebuke not a scorner, lest he hate thee, but rebuke a wise man, and he will love thee. Rebuke a wise man, says the proverb, and he will love thee. Mind you, of course, the rebuke still has to be given in private, doesn't it? When it says in Proverbs 27, by the way, verse 5, open rebuke, that doesn't mean that's not giving license to the idea that we ought to rebuke our friends in public. We still do it privately, don't we? After the Spirit of the Lord's teaching in Matthew 18, it is between thee and him alone. So it's not public criticism. The sense of the openness here is the frank sincerity with which it is given, but not in the public domain. And so I think the lesson of Proverbs 27 and verse 5 is it opens this idea of friendship. And what an interesting and valuable way to start off on the matter of friendship is this. The principle of verse 5 is this, that part of the secret of developing true friendships is that we have a spirit that will accept rebuke. Part of the secret of finding and developing true friendships is that we have a spirit that will accept rebuke. You see, there are those in ecclesial life that no matter what you say, you know that they're going to fly off the handle the moment the slightest breath of criticism is voiced on any subject. Very, very difficult to be close friends with those, isn't it? Now, if we really want to have true friends, we've got to be open to their rebukes. Mind you, we've got to be careful with rebuke, don't we? Because verse 6 says, and again in the context of friendship, faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. Now, by the way, the wounds here of verse 6, well, that's really the rebuke of verse 5, isn't it? So these are the rebukes of the friend, the faithful wounds. And they're faithful, you see. These wounds are not to hurt or to maim, they are to correct and to help us. And they're faithfully given. And there's a contrast with the second part of the proverb, because you see where it says the kisses of the enemy are deceitful. The word deceitful here really means to be abundant. It doesn't actually mean to be deceitful, it means to be abundant. In other words, the kisses of the enemy, to quote from the New International Version or others, the kisses of the enemy are profuse. So you see, there's a contrast here. The kisses of the enemy are multiplied, but the wounds of the faithful friends are therefore, by implication, sparing, aren't they? And I think that's a good lesson too, because you see, although there are times in life when true friends need to rebuke one another, they need to be sparingly administered. If you become overly fond of rebuking your friends, you'll find in the end that your friendships will be blighted for some strange reason. So we learn to administer such things sparingly, don't we, and in the faithful spirit of love. Actually, the verse really is a paradox, don't you think? Verse 6, you see, what happens is the wound comes from the friend and the kiss comes from the enemy. How strange. But it's all part of the principles of true friendship, you see. And so I think the lesson of the verse is this, that true friendship is not seen in the smothering protests of love or the frequent assertions of feeling that we have for one another, but more in those occasional acts of correction that seek true mutual improvement. True friendship is deeper than merely the outward tokens of affection. And part of the value of true friendships is that we're able to help each other in our development in the truth in this way. Now, you see what verse 7 says. Verse 7 says, the full soul loatheth an honeycomb, but to the hungry soul every bitter thing is sweet. The full soul loatheth an honeycomb. Now, do you know, the honeycomb here is taken really as a symbol of the sweetness of friendship. In fact, it comes from the word honeycomb here, comes from the same word translated sweetness in verse 9, which is going to be related to the subject again of friendship. So I think the lesson of verse 7 is this, that there's a warning here against the danger, funnily enough, of too much friendship. Now come back to chapter 25 And look at verses 16 and 17, because this is really the same principle. Actually, we never had time to look at these verses, so let's have a look at them now. 25, 16, and 17. Hast thou found honey? Eat so much as is sufficient for thee, lest thou be filled therewith and vomit it. Withdraw thy foot from thy neighbor's house, lest he be weary of thee and so hate thee. Now, you see the word weary in verse 17. Well, that's actually the same word as the word filled in verse 16. So you see, what verse 16 says is this. Have you found honey? Eat just enough. Don't eat ever more than enough. Do you know why? Because you see, what lies beyond enough? And we imagine that what lies beyond enough is ecstasy. But the proverb says, no, it's not. What lies beyond enough is nausea. So don't eat so much to the point where you're filled, because if you're filled with it, you'll actually find unpleasant things emerge. Now says verse 17, and here's the taking up, you see, of the proverb. Well, here's the honey, you see, verse 17, withdraw thy foot from thy neighbor's house. The honey here is the friendship that they enjoy. He says, well, be very careful. Because, you see, if you're in your neighbor's house too much, too often, too frequently, he might just become filled with you. And so hate thee. And the friendship will become nauseous. In other words, it's really saying your company may be very sweet, but you can have too much of a good thing, you know. So there's a danger here, actually, against friendship that is taken to excess, friendship that becomes smothering, friendship that becomes unwanted interference. Now, coming back to Proverbs 26 and verse 7, I think that's what it's saying. You see, the full soul loatheth an honeycomb. The lesson of this verse is that too much leads to loathing. Friendship can be strained by repeated or excessive contact. Even friends, even good friends, need privacy. They need space. They need room. We don't overdo it, you see. Mind you, the verse goes on to say, but to the hungry soul, every bitter thing is sweet. And so I think there's a warning here that, you see, loneliness is a hunger for company, isn't it? And those that are lonely have such a hunger for company that may lead them, says the proverb, into unwise friendships that are not helpful at all. They grasp at any friend that might come their way and imagine that it's sweet, but really it was bitter. And the proverb cautions against the danger of rushing into friendships that may in fact not be helpful at all to our development in the truth, simply because we're lonely. We've still got to be careful, you see. Friendships are special things and terribly important to whether we will develop in a spiritual way or not in a spiritual way. It all depends on the friends we have. And some friends will not be suitable. They will not be sweet. They will not be honey. They will in fact prove to be bitter companions. So where do we find those good and right and wholesome friendships that we all yearn to have? Well, the answer is, says verse 8, in a certain place. You see, verse 8 says, as a bird that wandereth from her nest, so is a man that wandereth from her place. And so just as verse 7 has cautioned against the dangers of too much friendship, too much contact, so verse 8 here now warns against the dangers of too little contact with our friends. Now you see, what's the nest here? Well, the nest is an interesting thing. Let me quote to you a certain passage from the prophecy of Isaiah. I'll just read you these words. This is a lovely expression about the nest. And my hand hath found as a nest the riches of the people, and as one gathereth eggs that are left, have I gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved the wing or opened the mouth or peeped. See, the nest is the place in Scripture where the little ones are reared, isn't it? It's the place where the young ones are, it's the place where the eggs are hatched and the little ones are reared. That's Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 14. You'll find a reference to that. Remember Psalm 84 verse 3, the swallow hath found a place, a nest for her young, a nest where she may lay her young, even thine altars, O Lord. The nest was the place where the little ones are brought up and nourished. Now, what the bird's done in verse 8 here is this bird, which, by the way, is a mother bird. You see, she wanders from her nest, not his nest. What she's done is she has deserted her charge and endangered her offspring. She's wandered off from the nest. And I think the lesson of the verse is this. You see, the nest is the ecclesia, isn't it? And the lesson of the verse is that it is in the ecclesial nest that godly friendships are reared. Not only is it the place where our children should be brought up, but it's the place where we find repose with other members of the family. If we keep the metaphor of the bird, the lesson of verse 8 is that the ecclesial nest is where others of the same brood are to be found. Now what verse 8 says is if you're always wandering from the nest, you'll never develop lasting and true friendships. Those friendships are to be found and nurtured in the ecclesial nest and not outside. So don't ever imagine that friendship in the world is the answer to our problems. It's not. You'll only find these friendships in the ecclesia. They're the true friendships. They're the only friendships that can lead us to proper spiritual growth, and how wonderful they are. And you see how wonderful they are because of what verse 9 says. Because verse 9 says, ointment and perfume rejoice the heart, and so doth the sweetness of a man's friend by hearty counsel. The Hebrew of this verse is a little difficult, but I think that the authorized version is basically correct. It suggests a parallel here, doesn't it? That, well, the Jerusalem Bible says, fragrant oil gladdens the heart, friendship's sweetness comforts the soul. So there's a parallel, you see, of ideas here, isn't there? And you see, verse 9 is really a lovely counterbalance to verse 6, isn't it? Because, you see, in verse 6 we have those wounds from the friend that bite and that sting. But in verse 9, we have the sweetness of counsel as a balm that soothes and that heals. And you see, both of these things are necessary in the development of friendships. There may be times for rebuke, says verse 6, but there's also a time for sympathetic care of one another, says verse 9. And we all need the counsel of the soul and the wonderful benefits that friendships bring. Remember these words? Again, I'll just quote them to you. We, it was thou, a man mine equal, my guide, mine acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together and walked unto the house of God in company. That's the lament of David concerning his friendship with Ahithophel in Psalm 55, verses 13 and 14. We took sweet counsel together. You see, that's what true friendship is all about, isn't it? Taking counsel, the one with the other. And we all need those opportunities in life. You know what friendship's really all about, brothers and sisters? The true value of friendship here. Friendship is all about the joy of being able to speak to another person from our hearts, to uncover our souls, and to do so with absolute confidence that what we say will be kept private and will be understood. Think of these passages. You know, in the 2nd of Chronicles 20 and verse 7, it says that Abraham was called the friend of God. You know why he was called the friend of God? I think he was called the friend of God because of a verse in Genesis 18, verse 17, where God says, shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I shall do? I think that's where the notion came from, that he was the friend of God. You see, because you know what friends are? Friends are those who take counsel with each other, you see. And God says, shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I shall do? And the answer, of course, is no, because he's my friend. And one takes counsel with friends. Remember these words in Exodus 33, verse 11. It says that God spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaketh unto his friend. says Exodus 33, verse 11. And John 15, verse 15 says, the Lord says to his disciples, I call you not servants, but I call you friends. For whatsoever things I have heard, these have I made known unto you. Friends are those who talk to one another and give counsel to each other, in the knowledge that those counsels will be respected and kept private between the friends. Now, which of us doesn't need the sweetness of that counsel in ecclesial life from our dearest friends? You know, one of the things I like concerning that ninth verse of Proverbs is, you see, although ointment and perfume rejoice the heart, and they're similar to the sweetness of counsel from friends, the sweetness of a friend's counsel is infinitely superior to ointment and perfume, isn't it? You know why? Because, you see, ointment and perfume, brothers and sisters, can only beautify the outward man. But the sweetness of friendship enriches the inner man. That's far more valuable, isn't it? How we need the sweetness of our friend's counsel. Verse 10 goes on to say in Proverbs 27, thine own friend and thy father's friend forsake not, neither go into thy brother's house in the day of thy calamity, for better is a neighbor that is near than a brother far off. Now, by the way, I don't think this is suggesting that the brother is evil or anything like that. What's the principle of the verse here? Well, I think the principle is this, that we've got to learn to value friendships that have been long established over time. And I've seen this happen, by the way, in ecclesial life, where a friendship has sprung up between two households in the truth because of like-mindedness, and that friendship has gone into the next generation. The children become friends because they also are like-minded in the things of the truth. These are long-established friendships that should be revered and valued. It's not saying that the brother is evil. What it is saying is that certain friendships are based upon principles that are higher and stronger than flesh and blood relationships. Isn't that what it says? That certain friendships are based on higher principles than merely flesh and blood relationships. Come and have a look at chapter 18. Here's the spirit, isn't it? Chapter 18, verse 24. Oh yes, these are the friendships that we ought to treasure. Thine own friend and thy father's friend forsake not. Here's the spirit of that, you see. Proverbs 18, verse 24. A man that hath friends must show himself friendly. And here it is. And there is a friend that sticketh closer than a brother. See, these are the friendships of the spirit, aren't they? This is the friend that sticks even closer than a brother. This is the friend and the father's friend that one ought not to forsake in Proverbs 27, verse 10. They are precious indeed. You know, brothers and sisters, I've always thought that this verse in Proverbs 27, verse 10, is a wonderful comfort to those who have come into the truth from outside, who have no mother and father in the truth, no grandparents, no aunts and uncles. And those that have come into the truth from outside have suffered loss, haven't they, of family relationships. And you see, what the proverb is saying is that there are friendships that are based on a higher and stronger and nobler principle than flesh and blood. And these friends stick closer than brothers. Don't ever forsake them. Treasure them. Anyone in the truth can find them, can have them, can treasure these special friendships that are unique within the brotherhood of God. And then verse 11 says, in Proverbs 27, my son, be wise and make my heart glad that I may answer him that reproacheth me. Now, it doesn't say, when it says my son here, we're not sure, of course, who's speaking. It could be one of two things. It could be an echo from the father of the previous verse, thy father's friend. And then almost as if from the past, out comes the father's voice. You see, my son. Or it could be that this is the term used, which was often used in biblical times, of the master or the teacher to his pupil, my son. Understand what I'm saying there? that a teacher would call his pupil my son. I don't think it matters, actually. Either would be the same. You know, in Matthew chapter 10, verse 25, which we won't turn up, it says that the disciple is not above his master, nor the servant above his Lord. Sufficient that the disciple become as his master. And I think that's the lesson of this verse, you see, that what this verse is saying is that either the father of a son or the teacher of a pupil, the lesson is the same for both of them, that their value is measured by how successfully they have imbued their sons or their pupils with their own principles. So what's the proof that a teacher has been wise or that a father has been prudent in the education of offspring? And the proof is, verse 11, that the son has formed wise friendships. There's the best proof that he's received wise instruction and the complete answer to any possible criticism or approach that may be leveled against the father or the teacher. And so whoever it is, I don't think it matters, the teacher or the father here says, my son, the best way of proving that these counsels that I give on friendship are right is for you to practice it. If you show true friendships in your life, then it's the answer to whoever may reproach me, says the teacher. So he appeals to us all, that we might learn these principles of friendship. Now, when verse 12 says, a prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, we've got one of these proverbs that's already been used before. We don't need to turn it up, but you'll find that it's in Proverbs 22 and verse 3. So we've already had this proverb. You see, it comes from the earlier collection of Solomon's writings. So remember, we asked ourselves the question before, well, why would he use a proverb that's already been used before? And the answer, of course, is now it's being brought together or brought into this particular chapter in a different context. The principle is the same, but the teaching is different. Now, what's the lesson of this verse? A prudent man foresees the evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. Well, firstly, let's take the basic meaning. You see, there's a difference between faith that things will work out and a blind optimism that everything will be just fine. You know, everyone sees evil when it's arrived, don't they? I think that's right. Everybody sees evil once it's arrived. But you see, what this verse says is that the prudent person foresees evil. That's the key, isn't it? The prudent person sees before it's even come, and they do something about it. They turn aside. The foolish blunder on smack into the problem. You can't stop them, you can't warn them, they won't be taught. They walk straight into the problem, and it hurts. The simple pass on and are punished. Now you see, the reason why I think this proverb is being used again is because Hezekiah is now bringing it into the context of friendship. The principle is now being applied in the context of friends and of friendships. And it's true, you see, that a prudent person sees an unnecessary conflict looming between friends, and he withdraws himself before an unnecessary argument between friends occurs. A prudent person stops that. And the simple person, through either naivety or stubbornness or aggressiveness or whatever their reason is, they push on and on until in the end they're punished, says the verse. You know what the word punished is here? The word punished means to inflict a penalty, especially a fine. Do you know what the fine is that the person pays in this verse? You know the penalty that they pay? They pay, brothers and sisters, the fine of a ruptured friendship. That's a high price indeed. And so the lesson of the proverb is that those that value friendships take due thought for the future consequences of their actions. They seek to preserve their friendships and not to endanger them by foolishly walking into a subject that will only hurt and damage the relationship that they have, the one with the other. They seek to avoid that. And then verse 13 says, and this is a stranger proverb still in its way, really, take his garment that is surety for a stranger, and take a pledge of him for a strange woman. Now you see, this is a proverb that's been used before as well. This is Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 16. But now here it is again in the 27th chapter being used all over again. Now what is this all about? Verse 13, take his garment that is surety for a stranger. Well, come back to chapter 17 just for a moment. I think there's a wonderful principle, in fact, in this verse. Now, in Proverbs 17, we have the teaching of Proverbs on the subject of suretyship. The word suretyship in the Authorized Version simply means what? Being a guarantor, acting as a guarantor for somebody else. Now, you see what verse 17, chapter 17 says, and in fact in verses 17 and 18. See how it brings these two ideas together. A friend loveth at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. A man void of understanding striketh hands and becomes a guarantor in the presence of his friend. Now you see this remarkable juxtaposition of ideas here in these two verses. On the one side it says, friends stick together through thick and thin. Doesn't matter what the trouble is, friends remain together and they help each other. And then almost in the same breath, in the very next verse, it says, don't ever be a guarantor for a friend. Only a fool does that. Isn't that remarkable? The one verse says how wonderful friends are as they stick together, and in the other verse, don't ever guarantee your friend. Now, why would it say that? Why would it bring those two ideas together? Do you think that this is a counsel or being exhorted to not be generous towards our friends? Now, I think that the lesson of this verse is not saying that we oughtn't to help our friends, but it's counsel against a blind guarantee that could ruin both people and destroy the friendship in the process. In fact, probably friends would be particularly susceptible to the dangers of this sort of thing. Look, I'm in a spot of bother. I wonder if you'd act as a guarantor to a little debt I've got. No, says Proverbs, that's actually not a good idea even for friends. Now, if it's not a good idea for friends, then is it a good idea for someone you don't know? The answer is, well, it would be even less of a good idea, really, wouldn't it? For someone, come and have a look at chapter 11. Now, chapter 11 makes it quite clear, really. What do the Proverbs teach concerning the idea of guaranteeing not a friend now, but becoming guarantor for a stranger? Well, Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 15 says, he that is surety for a stranger shall smart for it, and he that hateth suretyship is sure. Which is quite a nice little expression, really. So it's really, if we change that word to guarantee, we would have, he that is a guarantor for a stranger shall smart for it, and he that hateth guarantees is guaranteed. So really what it's saying is that imagine that you come to the judge, and that the people come before the judge and they say, I'm going to act as a guarantor here. So you'd say, okay, well, who's the debtor? And the debtor steps forward. How much is your debt? Oh, that big, right? Okay, let's write that down. Now, who's the guarantor? Oh, well, I am here, right? So you come forward now. Now, do you know the debtor? Oh, no, I've never met him in my life before. And so you are going to guarantee this man's debt, and you've never met him before. That's right. Well, says the proverb, it's going to hurt you. You'll sting for that, won't you? You'll be broken for that. You should never, ever become a guarantor for a person that you don't know. Proverbs says you shouldn't even guarantee friends. Now, come back to Proverbs 27. Now, remember, what's the context of our proverb? And the answer is, of course, we're talking in the context of friendships. So what's verse 13 teaching? Well, you see, I think that what it's saying is this. The proverb says, take his garment that is surety for a stranger. So what happens is when the two parties come before the judge, and so the one person says, well, I'm going to be the guarantor, and I pledge all of my worldly belongings as part of the guarantee for the debt of this other person I don't know. What the judge says is, okay, that's fine. I'll have the belongings now, thanks. I'll take your garment now. I'll hold you to your obligations now. Because you've been foolish enough to become the guarantor for a stranger. So I think the teaching of the proverb is this, now let's bring it to friendship, is that too much friendship extended to a total stranger is unwise. Friendship is a principle that grows over time, that needs to be tested and measured. We should not expect to enjoy close friendship with others until we've proved worthy of it, and nor should we extend the most intimate benefits of friendship until we truly know the person that we are seeking to become friends with. And so the lesson of this proverb is that a person who's foolish enough to extend the principles of friendship too early should be held to their obligations. They've rushed into it. They haven't been measured enough in the development of that friendship. Friendships are precious things, brothers and sisters, and they ought not to be taken lightly, nor entered into quickly. Verse 14 says, he that blesseth his friend with a loud voice, rising early in the morning, shall be counted a curse to him. You know, there are sort of different people in the truth, aren't there? There are those that we might call morning larks. They arise early in the morning. And there are those called night owls. They tend to go to bed late at night, and therefore their rising is not quite so early in the morning as the morning. And then I suppose that there are some who are sort of a combination of both. They go to bed early and they still get up late. We're all different, you see, as to what's the best time of the day for us. But, you see, I think the principle of this verse is this, that the idea of early in the morning here in this particular proverb is that it's not a good time. Not a good time for what? Well, it's not a good time for what the friend is doing. So what happens is you're fast asleep in your bed, the door bursts open, in comes your friend, slaps you on the back, "Hello, how are you today?" And well, shall we say it grates? It sort of irritates, doesn't it? In other words, an over-jolly heartiness at the wrong time. The lesson of the proverb is that good friends learn tact and sensitivity in dealing with one another. They're alert to the feelings of each other. They know how to read their friends. You know what I mean by that? They know how to read their friends' moods. And the lesson of the proverb is exaggerated praise or noisy flattery are not the marks of true friends. True friends don't need to loudly protest their love for each other. They already know that. They're sensitive and they're tactful in the maintenance of their friendships. A little proverb that says, the man who hails you Tom or Jack and proves by thumps upon your back how he esteems your merit is such a friend that one had need be very much his friend indeed to pardon or to bear it. Now we need to be careful, don't we, as to the way in which we handle our friendships. And here's another care that needs to be particularly noted in verse 15. Because it says there, a continual dropping in a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. Now, if you come back for a moment to chapter 19, we have what appears to be a similar proverb, and so it is, but with one slight addition. In Proverbs 19, we've really sort of already had this proverb before. It says there, a foolish son is the calamity of his father. And now in chapter 19, verse 13b, we could call it, we have our proverb, the contentions of a wife are a continual dropping. Now, that's not quite what Proverbs 27 says. You notice that Proverbs 27, coming back to it, verse 15, has made an addition. It's not just a contentious woman and a dropping. What verse 15 has added for us in this proverb here in chapter 27 is the time or the circumstance of the weather. You notice that? It's a very rainy day. So what we're being told in Proverbs 27 and verse 15 is this. You see, there's rain on the outside and there's rain on the inside. The one prevents us from going abroad with comfort, and the other, unfortunately, prevents us from staying at home in peace. The one rain really only wets to the skin, actually. The other seems somehow to wet to the very bone. You know, you can have an argument with a neighbour and it's like a sharp shower. It's over and it's gone. But this is a ceaseless downpour. And there's no means of shelter. Now, by the way, before our sisters should think that we are unpleasantly referring simply to the female of the species, it doesn't actually, in Proverbs 27, it doesn't actually mention a wife, does it? It simply says a woman, a contentious woman. And you see, in biblical times, that could be an aunt or a mother-in-law or it could be anyone who was in the household. And of course, in the ecclesia, we're the bride of Christ, aren't we? So we're all part of the woman of the house. So therefore, the spirit of this proverb could in fact apply to anyone in ecclesial life. But I think perhaps there is a special reminder in verse 15 that marriage is a special friendship, isn't it? Of all the friendships that we have, marriage is a special one. And the lesson of this proverb is that it can be undermined by certain types of behavior. This spirit of ceaseless criticism withers friendship. Sometimes this happens in ecclesial life. You know, someone will get a bee in their bonnet about a particular subject or a particular problem. It's not that the problem may not be real or true, but the real problem is they'll never give up on it. It goes on and on and on and on. And friendships are blighted by that sort of spirit, whether in a marriage or within the bounds of ecclesial life. There comes a time when a matter ought to be dropped. I've seen situations where an ecclesia has taken an ecclesial vote on a matter, and you think, at last, the issue is over and gone. No, it's not. No, it's not. Next Sunday, the dripping starts again. This ruptures friendship, doesn't it? It doesn't help. And verse 16 goes on to say, it says, "Whosoever hideth her, hideth the wind, and the ointment of his right hand, which bereaveth itself." I think the NASB is quite good here. It says, "He who would restrain her," or the Amplified Bible, "whoever attempts to restrain her might as well try to stop the wind." You know what happens when you try and stop the wind? You hear the wind whistling through, and so you shut the door and you shut the window, but there's still cracks there. And all that seems to happen is the wind roars louder and shrieks through the little openings that are left. It makes a bigger noise. The more you try to restrain it, you see, well, it's just like trying to restrain the contentious woman of these verses. And says the verse, "and the ointment of his right hand, which bereaveth itself." Now, there's a nice old English word. You see, what used to happen in biblical times is that the anointing oil that passed upon the body was poured into the right hand, you see, and the right hand would then anoint the body. And once it was all rubbed off, the hand would appear to be clean, wouldn't it? But the thing is that you could still smell the ointment. It bereaved itself. It called out from the hand. It looked like it had disappeared, but the scent reveals what has been done. And the word bereave, by the way, means literally that. It means to call out. So you see, I think the lesson of the verse is that the nature of a quarrelsome woman in the household eventually cannot be kept secret. It calls out. And it's actually an unwelcome scent, isn't it? Constant criticism destroys friendships. We need to be careful about that. And by way of contrast, and our concluding verse, verse 17, how wonderful this is. Verse 17 says, "Iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpeneth the counsel of his friend." And so here, by way of contrast now, is the wonderful privilege and the tremendous benefit of good friendship in the things of the truth. You see, here in this verse is the spirit of mutual debate. The vigorous testing of one another in the healthy competition of friendship. The spurring of one another on in spiritual things. Here is the bracing effect of friendship in the healthy interchange of spiritual thoughts. Mind you, of course, what the verse presupposes is that it is the striking of godly minds, the one against the other, that stimulates our spiritual growth. And in the striking of godly minds, the one against the other, like iron against iron, both are made keener, both are improved by the mutual experience of their friendship. And so true spiritual friendships are those which allow for the benefit of testing thought and sharpening principle upon and with each other, that we might grow together in the truth. How wonderful they are, brothers and sisters, the benefit of true friends. Even kings need those, you see. In the words of a hymn, brethren, let us walk together in the bonds of love and peace. Can it be a question whether brethren should from conflict cease? 'Tis in union, hope and joy and love increase. Then let each esteem his brother better than himself to be, and let each prefer another. Full of love, from envy free, happy are we, when in this we all agree.